Thank you. That's quite enough. You haven't heard what I've got to say yet. So that's, it's great. It's really good to be here. I am from that part of England called Yorkshire, which we know as God's own county. We discussed Yorkshire over dinner, and I discovered the only two Yorkshire references in culture the group at my table had heard of, very lovely group, had heard of, were a film called The Full Monty, which was made in Sheffield, where I live, and a film called Calendar Girls, which was made in a different part of Yorkshire. So clearly all you know about Yorkshire people is that they take their clothes off. Just before the memory of that wonderful video of the Archbishop fades from your mind, I want to say something about the room in which it's filmed. It's filmed in one of the rooms in Lambeth Palace, which is where it's called the conference room, where the Archbishop's Council meets. I've just been appointed to that body, which is a senior trustee and strategy body for the Church of England. I'll be there on Tuesday for a meeting chaired by Archbishop Rowan, and I'll certainly tell him that he sounded as if he was full of gin when he spoke in Edmonton. But actually, if you saw behind him, you saw a bookshelf, and immediately behind his head was what looked like a bookshelf, but is actually a cupboard door. That room used to be the Archbishop's study about two archbishops ago. And it was a kind of secret passage thing in the palace. Well, one of my delightful jobs as team leader of Fresh Expressions was to convene meetings when we brought in all of these wacky and unruly pioneer people to have meetings in Lambeth Palace. And when a normal group of people meet in that room, they're very respectful. But when the pioneers came, they would start lifting up cupboards and opening doors, and they opened this secret passage door. And who should they see sitting there when they open the door but Tigger from Winnie the Pooh? So last time I looked, he was still there. So next time you see that film clip or see a photo of that room, in the cupboard is Tigger. We like in the Church of England to keep our inner Tigger very out of sight and in a different place. Well, it's really good to be here. Thank you so much for the invitation. It's a privilege to be here, and Anne and I have enjoyed the trip very much so far. And before I get into what I have to say, I need to preface by saying that I'm here as a lifelong learner, really, and a student of what God is doing in mission and the life of the church. I'm very happy to share some of those experiences with you. But I don't regard myself as an expert or someone who has all the answers in my own situation, let alone in a country that I've been in for just a few days. I do believe that it's far healthier in Christian ministry, in my own context, to know that you don't know what to do and to wonder at what God is doing than to believe you have it all sewn up and neat and tidy. Conscious incompetence is far better than unconscious incompetence, if you know that phrase. And so I am a consciously incompetent bishop, and I hope to remain so for as long as my ministry lasts, really, because that will keep me open to what God is doing. As John says, I've been privileged to spend all my working life in Anglican ordained ministry, 13 years in parishes in my hometown of Halifax in the north of England, 8 years in Durham, being principal of a college where there will be about 90 Anglican and Methodist clergy in training at any one time. And it's while we were living in Durham, after we'd been there 8 years, that I was invited by the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, whom I'd only met at once, to meet with him and to explore setting up and leading his new initiative, Fresh Expressions. The year was 2004. Mission Shaped Church, the report the Archbishop refers to, had just been published. I thought it was a good piece of work. I was supervising somebody writing a thesis on it, so I'd read it, but there was no sign or thought in my mind that it would lead to significant change for the Church of England. So I travelled down to London, and I had an hour's interview with the Archbishop, which was a very new experience for me. And Archbishop Rowan told me in that interview that he wanted to make establishing fresh expressions of church one of his two main priorities for the Church of England for the whole of his time in office as Archbishop of Canterbury. The other priority was theological education. Well, I was almost rendered speechless to hear that, actually. Part of me wanted to say, do you really think that's wise? I mean, I didn't, because you don't say to the Archbishop of Canterbury, do you think that's wise? I told him 5 years later that's what I thought. How can the established church of the land embrace all of this new activity at its heart? So part of me was thinking that, and part of me was intrigued by the challenge. And that challenge was to take the ideas and concepts in Mission-Shaped Church, the idea of fresh expressions of church, and to help those ideas just become normal. No more than that, just normal, across the whole of the Church of England and the whole of the Methodist Church within a 5-year period. And it was one of those rare opportunities in Christian ministry when I could name my own budget, although it had to be raised, and appoint my own team. So I prayed, I said yes. I set my mobile phone ringtone to the Mission Impossible theme tune. And off we went. So the experience I'm bringing, I think, to your conference these 2 days, 3 days, is the experience of encouraging two national denominations at national level, at district and diocesan level, and at local level to embrace these new challenges of mission, the challenge to see fresh expressions of church move beyond simply being the radical edge of the church, an activity for the eccentric or the marginal, and become just normal, a normal mainstream activity for Anglicans. It's what we do. 7 years later, we've some way to go, but there's clear evidence of progress in our thinking, in our structures, in our budgets, and there is visible fruit from the work. And 4.5 years into that, 3 years ago, I was appointed Bishop of Sheffield back in Yorkshire. Just to give you some context for my work now, the diocese has a population of 1.2 million people. I have pastoral charge of over 200 parish churches and around 160 clergy. The diocese contains the city of Sheffield, which is the fourth largest in England in terms of population, and large areas of the industrial north, best known for coal and steel and heavy engineering, much of which has disappeared. I'm told churchgoing is among the lowest in Europe, in my part of England. South Yorkshire is one of the very poorest parts of the United Kingdom in economic terms, and the Diocese of Sheffield is also the most generous diocese in the Church of England in terms of its per capita giving as a proportion of income. It's full of the saints of God. We have some very old churches in our diocese. If I tell you that since I became bishop 2 years ago, I have preached and presided at two 900th anniversary celebrations of the foundations of churches. Our oldest church is Saxon. We have the church in our diocese where Robin Hood got married. There are about six other churches in the county where Robin Hood also got married. But we have a lot of people coming to get married there because of that. So we're one of the, we have some of the largest Anglican churches outside London on the west of the city of Sheffield. And we're one of the most diverse dioceses in the country in terms of the numbers of women clergy, conservative evangelicals, traditional Catholics, everything in between. I've been in post now about 2 years, and there have been years of developing fresh vision for church growth and the mixed economy church within the diocese. When a new bishop is appointed to a diocese in England, the Archbishop of the province, in my case, the Archbishop of York, John Sontamu, delivers to the new bishop a solemn charge. And the charge is developed from the diocese's own statement of needs, and it becomes the new bishop's job description. So as an indication of how far this language of fresh expressions and the mixed economy church has spread in the Church of England, this is my charge from the Archbishop of York. This is my job description as Bishop of Sheffield. Build a structured and creative approach to mission, ministry, and evangelism. Encourage a mixed economy of fresh expressions of church and inherited forms. Communicate in your preaching and teaching the Christian faith with clarity and conviction. Develop a vision for the future for the whole people of God. There are two or three other points, but that's big enough, isn't it? So please pray for the Diocese of Sheffield. We begin on Thursday, 2 days' time. We're 2 days away from our second of what will be an annual period. I've called every year for 10 days of prayer from Ascension to Pentecost for the diocese, asking every parish to pray for God's grace and resourcing in God's mission. There are no central events. Every parish does its own thing. But all across the diocese, every church will be praying for this common vision. And this next slide is our diocesan vision statement. The Diocese of Sheffield is called to grow a sustainable network of Christ-like, lively, and diverse Christian communities in every place, which are effective in making disciples and in seeking to transform our society and God's world. So what I share with you in this session and tomorrow arises from that vision of what the church is called to be and to do, to grow Christ-like communities. In addition to my responsibilities in Sheffield, like many bishops in the Church of England, I have national responsibilities. I serve on a number of groups, including the Archbishop's Council, and I've just been appointed to the Ministry Council of the Church of England with a view to chairing that body next year. So in that role, I will oversee everything to do with the selection, training, and deployment of our ordained ministry. Just so you know a bit more about us while we're here, Anne and I have four children, two boys and two girls. Both our girls are doing exams this week. One of our sons works for a Christian youth ministry called Soul Survivor. The other has his own games design business. Anne's a nursery nurse as well as a wife and mother. In my spare time, I write. It's my leisure interest. And I also cook. So I look forward to getting to know you and working with you. Tonight's address, I want to reflect on the mission and missiology which underlies our engagement with Fresh Expressions of Church. And then tomorrow, I'm going to explore a perspective and something of a vision for what it means to be the church. I hope that will be helpful. But the two questions of what is mission and what is church shape what I have to say. And my starting point in this reflection is one of the stories in the Gospels about the call of the first disciples, and in particular the two invitations Jesus gives in Luke 5, the call to put out into deep water and let down the nets, and the call to become fishers of people. I guess you know the passage well. Jesus has been teaching from Simon Peter's boat. And when he finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into the deep water and let down your nets for a catch." Put out into deep water. Those are words I need to hear as a disciple and as a bishop in the 21st century church. And I believe you need to hear them as well as the Lord's call to us. I hear them as a call to move out beyond our safe places and shallow waters to where people are who need to hear and receive the gospel. They're a call to go to where people are, sometimes way beyond the reach of our congregation. And Simon answers Jesus' call with some of the same excuses that we bring. Master, we have worked all night long, but have caught nothing. This is not the perspective of hope. Listen to the way in which Simon's previous experiences shape his response to Jesus and his actions. His tiredness, his sense of failure, his weariness of initiatives and new ideas all control the way he hears Jesus' words. It might be that you have a similar response to the idea of letting down the nets again into deep water. Well, we tried that and it didn't work. But for Simon, his growing regard for Jesus overcomes his sense of failure and his experience, because there is a second part to his response. Yet, if you say so, I will let down the nets. And Simon's response brings me to the first lesson I want to share. What is it that motivates the Church of God in mission and evangelism? For I think our motivation in this enterprise is critical. What is it that is going to excite the church again about communicating and sharing the gospel? What is it that enables us to get past our experiences and into something new? What can we say to motivate a small group of Christians meeting on a housing estate, a group of church leaders like this one, a great synod of the church? Why are we concerned to communicate the gospel and grow the church? Well, let me say two things from my experience of the Church of England in the past and present. The decline of the church is not sufficient or adequate motivation for introducing change. The decline of the church is not enough motivation for change. The preservation of the church in a particular way is not sufficient motivation for change either. Being excited by the technical details of fresh expressions of church is insufficient motivation. A small number of technical people might get excited about such things, but they'll never rekindle a fire in the church as a whole. And hearing of what works elsewhere is not sufficient motivation for change. The matter is much, much, much deeper. The challenge of motivating the church again to a fresh vision for mission and evangelism and growing new communities is a matter of catching again a fresh vision of Jesus Christ. If you say so, I will let down the nets. Pope John Paul II published at the millennium a very moving letter to the churches. Its Latin title is In Novo Millennio Innuente. And the letter is to inaugurate the third millennium of the Christian Church. In his letter, the Pope calls for a new evangelization of the world by new methods. But he writes that this new evangelization cannot be about technique. And I believe he would include in that the techniques of forming new communities alongside methods of personal evangelism. The new evangelization must begin by encountering afresh the person of Jesus Christ and becoming so captivated again by the Son of God that we're able to hear his call to put out into deep water and let down the nets. These are the Pope's words. It's not therefore a matter of inventing a new program. The program already exists. It is the plan found in the gospel and in the living tradition. Ultimately, it has its center in Christ, who is to be known, loved, and imitated, so that in him we may live the life of the Trinity and with him transform history until its fulfillment in the heavenly Jerusalem. I know from many experiences of seeking to engage and motivate the church to mission and evangelism that the threat of decline is not enough. I've lost count of the number of presentations I've listened to which begin with a downward sloping graph of church attendance. Do you have them here? The speaker normally projects the graph forward so that within 25 or 30 years, the church is gone altogether and invites the last person in the room to turn out the lights. Do such presentations motivate the church for evangelism? No. Instead, they induce a sense of failure and guilt. Stories of what works elsewhere is not enough either. The heart of the church must be challenged. People need to encounter again the wonder of the living Christ, how wonderful Jesus Christ is. We need ourselves to be re-evangelized, and then we're ready to hear Christ's call. If you say so, if you say so, I will let down the nets. In any walk of life, new vision comes as leaders nurture themselves and nurture others in two disciplines. The first is seeing the reality, what is, in a disciplined and accurate way, and that is important. But the second discipline is nurturing the vision of what could be. And in the church, ironically, that is what we often neglect. We're quite good at reality. We are less good at nourishing the vision of Jesus Christ, who calls us to put out into deep water. But once we've grasped that fresh vision of Jesus and communicating the love of Christ to a new generation, what then? Well, this is what seems to be happening in our own context, if we could move on to the next slide. For several generations, the gap between where the church is and where our society is has been growing further and further and further apart. And the flow of people from our wider society into the life of the church becomes less and less year by year. It's still there, but it's much less than it was. But then something else began to happen. Two more clicks, I think. Right, that's great. Christians within the existing church began to hear from Jesus this call to go into deep waters and let down the nets. So they began to go and cross the divide into the surrounding culture. At first, they went with a view to drawing people back into the existing church. But then these new missionaries discovered they were not called to go and draw people back. They were called to go and stay and sit and listen and form new communities for that culture and that group, which would themselves be fully church. These people did not know how to do what they were doing, and nobody told them to do it. There were very few models. There were very few theological principles. There was no language to describe what was happening. But the awareness that this kind of movement needed to happen was birthed in the Church of England very rapidly across a 10-year period from the mid-1990s to the early 2000s. At first, there were just scattered experiments. Then one or two people began to notice what was happening, and that this was becoming more common, and they began to tell the stories. Then the Church of England centrally thought it would be good to look at this in more detail and commissioned a working party to produce the report that became Mission-Shaped Church. This was not an abstract piece of strategy. This was an attempt to listen to what was happening. Nobody was expecting Mission-Shaped Church to be a runaway success or even significant. But you may have heard it was called for a while the Harry Potter of Christian publishing. it sold so many thousands of copies. But Mission Shaped Church did not create a movement. It named a movement. It gave language and concepts and ideas to frame something which was already going on in many different places, and it was a fruit of good listening. People were feeling after these ideas, but we didn't have the language or the skills or the deep wisdom, but we did know as a church what God was calling us to do. In my first year as Archbishop's missioner in this role, I worked without a team and I travelled to every part of the country listening to stories from people who were doing this. At that point, I just didn't know how much was going on. I thought the authors of the report might have put in every story that they knew at that stage. There was only one way to find out, and that was to go and see. So I went to every diocese in every part of the country, and I'd invite somebody to gather a group together, and I'd introduce myself, and then just ask people to tell me their stories. Over and over and over again, I would hear this kind of language about hearing a call and going and sitting and listening and praying for a new thing to grow. Over and over again, I'd hear phrases like, "We don't really know what we're doing. We're taking this one step at a time." There was both a deep humility and a deep provisionality to it. This was not a brand or a program. Something was growing from the ground up. Mission Shaped Church named what was happening and blessed it and encouraged it. Here's another way to describe what was happening in our social context. England is its own place, and similarities to Canada may or may not be there. You'll have to judge that. But the Church of England over the last two generations has needed to wake up to the reality that the set of ideas known as Christendom is no longer a helpful way to see our society. In a Christendom view of the world, people are assumed to be Christian. Society is shaped in a very deep way in this valley formation, so as to draw people into contact with the life of the Christian church. The way public holidays are constructed, the role of the church in rites of passage, the role of chaplaincy in our national institutions, the establishment of the church in national life in our case, are all designed to weave Christian faith through the tapestry of the whole of society. And in that kind of society, just living life itself brings people to the doors of the church. And our mission task then is to draw them to Christian discipleship through the font and to the table of the Lord. Now, the idea of Christendom is, of course, a social construct. It's a lens through which we see and filter a complex reality, and it's not the only way to see that reality, but it does make sense of a lot. For two or three generations, this pattern of the valley has been changing. We go on to the next slide, Ryan. For some in the older generation, that pattern still applies, but their number is diminishing. For many in the younger generation, the deep shaping of their society now draws them not towards the life of the Christian community, but away from the life of the church. And we've had to face the question as a church, what should we do in this situation? What is Jesus Christ saying to us? One alternative will be this. Should we accept the situation as it is and discern that we are called to minister to one part of the population only? The part on the right hand of that diagram. The part which has some kind of residual Christian faith. That is, after all, where we feel most comfortable, where we are used to ministering, where we have a deep wisdom accumulated over centuries. In some ways, that would be a very attractive option, and it's a choice which many Christian churches have made in periods of decline and change. It may be a choice which faces you as a congregation or a minister or as a diocese or as the church in this place. But there are two problems with that approach to this reality. The first is that the proportion of the population on the right of that diagram grows less with each generation. With each 10-year banding, the proportion on each side shifts dramatically. So to take that route will be to accept that our future will be to be marginal in the life of our culture. The second reason is much more serious, and it is that it is absolutely impossible, in my view, to read the Gospels and to reconcile that approach with the truth of the Incarnation and the pattern of the ministry of Jesus. It's at the heart of what we believe that God does not wait for us to come to Him. The Father sends the Son. The Son says to His disciples, "As the Father sent me, so I send you." Jesus prioritizes in His ministry the lost and the least and the last, those who are far from grace, put down into deep water and let down their nets. So we discern a call to engage in God's mission to the whole of our society. Some will come to us, many will not. And so we must go to them. We must put down into deep water and let down the nets. We must go out of our comfort zone, take some risks, not so that the church will survive, but so that lost people might encounter Jesus Christ. As I made my pilgrimage round the country, it became very clear that this was not a handful of scattered experiments. Something new was breaking out in thousands of different places. It needed encouragement and structure, but the Church of England as a whole was grasping the logic of what needed to happen. And as thousands of people have set out on that journey of exploration, then as we go, we've tried to develop a language and a methodology and a theology which undergirds and makes sense of what we're doing. Some of that's becoming quite secure, and some remains quite tentative. It's a new territory we're exploring. The term Fresh Expressions of Church has on the whole been helpful. It's not something I'm particularly purist about. I don't really mind whether people call something a fresh expression of church or a church plant or an emerging church or whatever. But I do kind of mind what that something is for. If it's formed for those at present outside the church, then that's what I'm interested in. If it's formed for those presently inside the church, to give them some different kind of consumer experience, then for me that's much less interesting and much less central to what this is about. The term Fresh Expression of Church was coined by the working party who wrote Mission Shaped Church. It was new language and chosen as a neutral term which could embrace a wide range of different realities, from additional services on Sunday to youth congregations to midweek ventures to completely new experiments. It has some resonance with an important paragraph for the Church of England called our Declaration of Assent, in which every ordained Anglican at the beginning of every new ministry promises to proclaim the gospel afresh to each generation. In the beginning, it was a deliberately vague term, although we learned quickly to always use the phrase fresh expression of church, because other things could be fresh expressions of mission or social action or care, but we were looking at something which had the potential to be the church. This is the next slide, the definition of fresh expression of church, which we developed in the United Kingdom to develop and fill out the phrase. A fresh expression of church is a form of church for our changing culture, established primarily for the benefit of people who are not yet members of any church. It will come into being through principles of listening, service, incarnational mission, and making disciples. It's about going, sitting, listening, serving, forming community, and so discipleship and worship. And it will have the potential to become a mature expression of church, shaped by the gospel and the enduring marks of the church and for its cultural context. The shaping of this community and its maturing will happen over time and will be a twofold dialogue between the tradition and the cultural context. The term mixed economy church, referred to already this evening, has been extremely helpful as well. This was a vital, vital piece of language in the beginning, and it continues to be very important, coined originally by Rowan Williams as part of his vision for the Church of England back in his first year in office. And the justification for the mixed economy is that we live in this transitional period between Christendom and post-Christendom, when everything is shifting and changing all the time. And in this period, we will need different kinds of churches to connect with different parts of our society. One kind of church can't do everything in a shifting social context. We need them all. And we need to affirm and bless many different fresh expressions of church alongside what we've inherited. The two can work together. In the Church of England at the present time, the two most significant growth points are cathedral congregations on the one hand and fresh expressions of church on the other, at each end of that radical and traditional spectrum. And it's this mixed economy language and that kind of insight which has prevented the fresh expressions movement splintering away from the inherited church, and which enables fresh expressions to give new life to the inherited church. This is a both-and vision, not an either-or. At the beginning of the journey, it was really touch and go whether the more radical voices in this movement would prevail. Authors and practitioners were becoming influential, who were calling for what they called the emerging church to come out and separate from the inherited. In 2003, our most radical, committed pioneers were right on the threshold. The door was open, and they could have left. Such movements have happened before in the Church of England's recent history. In Mission Shaped Church and in Blessing Fresh Expressions, the Church of England took a gigantic step in the direction of new forms of church and embraced them as a normal part of the whole. And in return, those forming fresh expressions became content to work within the mixed economy structure. And those terms taken together, mixed economy and fresh expressions, describe a new, fairly fluid reality in ordinary parish life. Many, many parishes, a substantial proportion, now have some kind of fresh expression of church as part of their overall life. The mixed economy is happening on the ground. As well as Sunday morning services at 10, there might well be in the same parish a midweek congregation, a cluster of cells, a deanery youth service, a messy church on Wednesday afternoon, and so on and so forth. Over the last decade, midweek attendance at Church of England worship services has grown by something like 40%. We're now in contact with as many children and young people through explicitly Christian midweek services and activities as we are on Sundays. Most of those have been established on fresh expressions principles as part of a mixed economy parish and deanery. And this both-and approach has enabled us to connect together, on the one hand, this multitude of initiatives in parishes and deaneries, and on the other, the handful of bold, radical experiments which a diocese might sponsor and for which we might pay someone in full-time ministry. They're part of the same movement. The both-and approach has also enabled us to argue, and I think win the case, that this movement is not just for a few parishes, but in time for every parish, and a key way forward. The term pioneer minister has been useful, third piece of language. We needed a term to describe the particular cluster of gifts needed for forming fresh expressions of church. That language has settled, and we use the term pioneer minister, or just pioneer. For the last 4 years, the Church of England has had a pathway for people to be called to pioneering as a focus of their ordained ministry. All ordinands now are called to have some training in pioneer ministry, but some ordinands are called to pioneer new congregations as a central part of their ministry. Once we'd selected our first 50 or 60, we got them together for a day with Archbishop Rowan, and we asked them what would have happened to them if this track had not been available. I think about a third would have come through anyway. Some of our ministers have always been pioneering. And the remaining two-thirds divided into two. A third had been forward for selection in the last 3 to 5 years and had not been recommended because their gifts had not been recognized within the ambit of ordained ministry. And another third said they wouldn't even have thought about offering for ordination unless they could focus on pioneering. We've introduced a careful, principled loosening of our structures around ordination selection and training to make this possible. Pioneer ministry for the ordained is not a different category of ordained ministry. There is one ordained ministry, but it is a focus of that ministry for some. So pioneers are selected against an additional set of criteria. There's an additional flexibility in their training, so they can train alongside what they're doing. They're normally deployed in their first post to pioneer a fresh expression of church. And if you read our church press, there are job adverts almost every week for full-time pioneers in different parts of the country as the church invests its resources here. We pay careful attention, or we try to training the pioneers need to equip them for that ministry and to the theological undergirding of that ministry in diaconia, the diaconal ministry, the ministry of serving and listening and being sent as an agent of God's love in the world. A mission-shaped ministry, which is on offer here, has been rolled out across Britain. A significant number of our colleges and courses now offer training in this. And we believe that ordained pioneer ministry has led to an increase of younger vocations, not just the pioneers, but those who are encouraged because of all of this to believe that the Church of England has a long-term future and is worthy of a lifetime commitment. You've been listening for a while. There's a bit more to go. I'm going to suggest you talk to the person next to you for a minute. You can talk about anything you like. It doesn't have to be about what I've said. Just give yourself an attention break. If you don't like the person you're sitting next to, go and find somebody else to talk to. 2 minutes. Thank you. I'm going to do the next section, and which is an important part of the puzzle. And then we'll have some time for questions. And then I've got 5 minutes to do right at the end by way of conclusion. So short section. Questions, and I think there's a mic at the back if people want to ask questions or respond, and then 5 minutes at the end before we finish. So I've been asking myself over the years and puzzling quite a lot about why all this has been happening in the Church of England. Well, I don't know for sure, I have to say. But I think all of these developments that we have experienced are undergirded by something of a fundamental shift in the Church of England in terms of our understanding of God's mission and the centrality of mission, by a shift in our missiology over the last two generations. For whatever reason, and I'll have a stab at offering you a couple, over the last 50 years, the Church of England has embraced at its theological heart the concept of the mission of God, the Missio Dei, as the central shaping pattern for the life of the Church. Mission is central to God, the Trinity. The Father sends the Son, the Father and the Son together send the Spirit. The calling of the Church is to join in this act of divine sending as a central part of its life. And that deep theological stream of focusing on the mission of God, underground stream, is feeding the growth of so many fresh expressions of church. And that concept of the mission of God has over two generations come to shape our theological identity, our language, our training for ministry, our liturgies of ordination, and who we are as a church. If you're asking yourself the question, does he really know what he's talking about and want to go somewhere very quickly, have a look at the new ordination services in our Common Worship Ordinal, which are on the Church of England's website. Look at the charge to deacons, the charge to priests, the charge to bishops. The primarily defining phrase for a bishop in the Church of England is a leader of God's mission. Now, I don't fully understand how that shift happened, but I can point to two important and linked influences, and they're both to do with the world church. The first is a stream of Anglican and other missionary theologians, stretching back to the 18th century, who have gone out from the Christendom mentality of the Church of England and other places to the mission fields of Asia or Africa or India, and who've been profoundly challenged by their experiences and have rediscovered Christianity as a movement of mission. And in different ways, they've been called back to work in Britain or North America and have reflected on their experiences and have forged a new missiology for the church which sent them. One of the most widely read texts in the emerging church and fresh expressions movement in the United Kingdom is Vincent Donovan's book, Christianity Rediscovered. And of course, John Bowen here is an expert on Donovan's work. And many of you will have read the book. It tells the story of Donovan's attempts to go to the Maasai people and the way he abandoned the ways which were not working and sought simply to live with them and translate the gospel into their language and culture. Donovan says in his foreword to the book that his chief influence was the Anglican missiologist Roland Allen, a USPG missionary to China, who went to Asia, saw what was not working, and returned and reflected on his own situations. One of his classic texts, still in print, St. Paul's Missionary, Missionary Methods, St. Paul's or Ours. This line of distinguished theologians includes Faraz, Henry Venn, Max Warren, John V. Taylor, Leslie Newbegin, and others. And the Church of England's missionary endeavors, imperfect though they are, has, it were, been reborn in the Church of England's mission consciousness in respect of our own community and culture. And the second major influence upon us is undoubtedly the Anglican Communion, and the missiology which has been informed and been embraced by successive Lambeth conferences. I've done a little bit of work over the last 5 years with the churches in Scandinavia and in Germany, and have puzzled over why the same missional reawakening has not happened in the same way in those contexts. And one of the reasons is, although they are part of worldwide churches, they don't have the same relationship quite as the Church of England has with the Anglican Communion. You will, I know, be very familiar with the five marks of mission for the Anglican Communion. They're not a perfect or complete statement by any means, and I have personally to remain dissatisfied with any statement about Christian mission which doesn't mention Jesus. But the five marks do represent a summary of God's mission with which all Anglicans can identify now and make their own, and to proclaim the good news of the kingdom, to teach, baptize, and nurture new believers, to respond to human need by loving service, to seek to transform unjust structures of society, to strive to safeguard the integrity of creation, and sustain and renew the life of the earth. As you know, there's a conference taking place a few doors down in Toronto, which is about reflection on the five marks, which is really interesting, an Edinburgh 2010 conference. But as you know, the first mark of mission is commonly understood as being the headline, which is unpacked by the other four. And we've wrestled in the Church of England over the last generation or so with a pervasive false dichotomy, a false alternative, between the second mark, to teach, nurture, and baptize new believers, and marks 3, 4, and 5. And the view remains that you can be committed in the Church of England either to evangelism or to Christian service and social action, that it has somehow to be a choice. Where that idea came from, I do not know. Much of the influential literature on our church life in the 1980s and 1990s in England came from the United States and the church growth movement. That movement did set a priority on evangelism over social concern and action. And for that reason, that church growth movement sits very uneasily with an Anglican theology of mission, which holds to a concern for all five marks and not simply the second. The mission-shaped church report has been critiqued, rightly in my view, for being overly shaped by an evangelism or church growth missiology. So we can veer too much to that side still. However, there are many other streams in the Church of England's life which have found no place for evangelism or making disciples of Jesus Christ. Streams where the focus is entirely on spending our spiritual capital to exhaustion and taking no thought for rebuilding or growing again the church in future generations. Either of those pathways separately lead to a distortion of what it means to be the church. And we need to leave this tired dichotomy behind us. In my own diocese, we need to put some thought into how to grow the church and to make disciples and put resources there. But we need also to put thought into enabling local churches to serve and bless and transform their communities. That's the kind of church Jesus calls us to build. The Church of England as a whole in February committed itself to three priorities for the coming quinquennium: working for the common good, Marks 3, 4, and 5, growing the church, Mark 2, and reimagining ministry in a way that makes both of those possible. The practice of fresh expressions of church makes it essential to bind those two elements together. If we can go to the next slide. A fresh expression of church begins with listening and discernment. It moves on, while the listening continues, with service to the wider community, incarnational mission. In the midst of that service, often a community of people will grow. In the midst of that community, there is the possibility of making disciples. As though disciples come together, there is a need for worship, and the whole life of that fresh expression develops and grows from that point. I have some more to say right at the end, but I think it would be great if there was an opportunity now for questions and some interaction. I'd love to hear what you think. So we're not going to have a separate chair. If people would like to speak, we're going to suggest you go to the microphone at the back, or is it going to come? The mic will come to you. Okay, this is the point where I say come down out of your seats and if you want to ask a question. But Judith has the microphone, so if you'd like to speak or respond, you're very welcome.
One of the things that intrigued me was the increase in attendance at midweek events and midweek services. One of the things, I'm a minister in the United Church of Canada, and one of the things we've been struggling with is trying to find ways of finding church that works for people who can't do the Sunday mornings.
Yeah.
What have been sort of the commonalities in your experience that have led to these being this 40% increase, and so that we could learn from your experience?
Yeah, thank you. Well, actually, that's happened without us noticing a lot of it. And it's simply about sometimes having a midweek service. Of any kind. It could be a Wednesday morning 10 o'clock traditional communion, or something that happens for families at 5 o'clock on a Saturday. A very large proportion of adults in England now have to work at least some Sundays. And Sundays is not a church which operates only on Sundays, which a lot of us had begun to do, was never going to be suitable for that changing social context. But the shift that we've had to make is from seeing midweek services as additional to or supplementary to people coming on Sundays and beginning to see them as church. And actually, that's a very good, rich shift to make in any case. When I was a vicar, I did what most Church of England clergy do, and I'm sure many of you do. I would take Holy Communion services in nursing homes in the parish once a month. We'd go together. And often I'd go on my own. Sometimes I'd take one person with me. If you'd asked me what I thought I was doing, I'd have said I was taking a service in that place. I would now see that very differently, and in my language and thinking, I would make an ecclesiological shift, and I would say, I'm creating and sustaining and building the church in that place. And that is, it's as simple as that. It's not about doing any different activity sometimes. Sometimes it is, but it's about thinking differently about what we're doing. So we have a richer ecclesiology. So I'd have involved people in leading the worship. I'd have built fellowship and tried to build mission and connection to the Sunday service instead of being the priest who went and did it, as it were. Okay, you've no more questions, so that's fine. Really? Okay, you want a bit? One more, yeah.
I'd just like to encourage you to talk a little bit more about how we, how we help congregations to embrace some of the things we're speaking of. I feel like I live and serve in probably Christendom's last gasp in North America. You know. And East Coast Canada, conservative in all things. And I just feel that there's a kind of a disconnect. I mean, people see what I do at 8 o'clock on Sunday morning as legitimate church. You know, there's 11 of them, but it's the real thing. And what happens on Wednesday night when 40 teenagers get together and want to make pizzas and do stuff, that's seen as... I mean, I get resistance if they even use the kitchen, you know? So I guess I just want to talk more about how we motivate the church or convince the church that these other things are church.
Yeah, thank you. I think the question raises an important point that different Christian communities actually do find it harder or easier to embrace this. And certainly in the Church of England, the hardest groups to, the slowest groups to embrace it, though they are beginning to do now, have been places where church, as we've always done it, is still working well. So larger congregations and communities have found it more difficult. I think the route for me to helping groups unpack that question is what I'll be talking about tomorrow night. But it takes us to the heart of what is the church. And I think, speaking for my own church, the Church of England, we've not asked the question for a long time, what is the church? We are impoverished in our ecclesiology, to use technical language, and we need to grow some new muscles there. And therefore, anything that helps a particular community reflect on what it means to be the church is really, really useful in that, and helps us get away from the very powerful formation we've all had, that a church is wooden benches facing the same way, stone building, person at the front in robes, and nothing else is. Which, of course, as soon as you name it, you realize that's not true, but we all have it.
I have to confess a little envy as we began tonight, and to hear kind of the passionate advocate you have in the primate, who is at the very heart of the structures of the inherited church, advocating so passionately and convincingly for this new movement. And in a denomination where my observation is the church at a structural level is often busily trying to kill anything that seems to come to life in its midst. However, I suspect that you have also experienced some of that structural reaction to the new, and I wonder if there's any insight you can share with us who also struggle with that around how to foster the transformation of structures to allow space for these new ministries to flourish.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Two things there. The first is I have been intrigued and surprised by the degree to which what I've come to call blessing these initiatives makes a difference to them. When I have to confess, when I was a vicar and my bishop told me to do or not do something, I didn't really take that much notice. You know, it was... I'm very sorry, Colin. I should probably have, you know, that's definitely not how to get on in the Church of England. But you know, people just got on with it. But there's something about this that, as I've travelled around from, you know, we have 44 different dioceses, as I've gone around from diocese to diocese, the take up of these ideas has been significantly affected by Archbishop Rowan blessing it, but also whether the local bishop saying, you know, you should be doing this stuff. And, you know, I went to one day in Lincoln Cathedral, ancient cathedral. Bishop John Saxby has just retired. We had about 1,000 people in the cathedral, and he stood at the front of the cathedral with his Methodist counterpart. It was an ecumenical day. And he said, we want you to know that we think you should be doing this stuff. And when you do it and it doesn't work, we will be right behind you and we will back you and support you. And I was very, you know, I wanted to kind of weep afterwards. John's of a different Anglican tradition from me, but he was right behind it. And it's something about this being slightly out of the ordinary that having the permission and the blessing really helps and really counts. Second thing is the change of the structures. Yes, we found it very difficult. And the first time I brought the proposals on ordained pioneer ministry to our House of Bishops, for agreement, the first 5 or 6 speeches from the bishops were all against it, very strongly. You know, so I was kind of thinking, you know, what am I doing here? And it took I think it took 8 or 9 drafting attempts to get that right. And it's with things like that, and with the other thing we have called Bishops' Mission Orders for recognizing new communities. It's like. A few of us have had to go down to the engine room of the ship, and we've had to work down there and forge new bits of gearing for the church, which hopefully in 10 years' time will be invisible and nobody will know they're there. But actually forging them has taken a lot of blood, sweat, and tears and prayer. So that structural change doesn't happen overnight, but it does make a difference to have Archbishop Rowan Williams on, you know, rowing in the boat. That's...
Bishop, not to sound crass, but when we use terms like fresh expressions, mission-shaped church, and pioneer ministry, but then when I compare that to what I hear you saying, it almost sounds like fresh coats of paint on a rather old exterior, and I mean that as a compliment, that what you described was not about us trying to take on new habits and practices that we have to learn, but in fact what's worked in England has actually been to return to what's part of our Christian DNA. And I don't know if that's accurate and how that happened. I guess I also wonder, how did we ever forget who we are? And how did we reclaim that?
Yeah, thank you. Yes, kind of. I mean, there is genuine innovation and new things, particularly at the edges of the movement. I mean, people are immensely creative and exciting, interesting things are happening. But any movement of renewal, not just in the church but in most other communities, is nearly always a return and a rediscovery of the founding vision. And the word radical, as you will all know, means going back to the roots. So I think going back to the foundation of what it means to be the church and what it means to be engaged in God's mission is what this is about. And that comes up with some new results, really, when we bring it back into the present. So I think that is, it's the Ecclesia Reformata et Semper Reformanda dynamic, the church reformed and always needing to be reformed and renewed. And that's what's happening here.
We will have time for questions tomorrow, but Steve, if you want to bring
thank you. Thank you very much. I just want to return to the story of Simon in the boat and just finally end with one perspective on something which touches on the penultimate question about changing the structures, which is a really important quality. Simon's willing to do as Jesus asks, let down the nets into deep water. The catch exceeds his expectations. They have to call for their partners in the other boat to come and help them. Even so, the boats can barely contain all the fish they net. And as the boat comes back into land, Simon and the small community have to reassess who they are and their relationship with Jesus. And in my experience, mission always involves shining that light backwards. The one who is catching fish is himself evangelized. Not the only time this happens to Simon Peter. Go away from me, Lord, he cries, for I'm a sinful man. And the others are both amazed and afraid, but Jesus calls them as a community to a new commission, to catch people for the kingdom of God, at words which in Luke echo Ezekiel's prophecy of the river of life. Let me take you back to that moment when Jesus invites Peter to let down the nets, and Peter hovers between the lessons of experience and the call of faith. And it might be that you or your whole church is poised in that moment. For there is a virtue which I found to be vital for this work since I first began to do it. It's a vital virtue for pioneers, and it's a vital virtue for those who would encourage and bless the pioneers and to seek to change the structures of God's church. And it's the virtue and perspective of Christian hope. In England, I think we'd almost forgotten about Christian hope as a virtue. We'd swallowed the lie from the culture around us that hope is some kind of mood, it's how you're feeling on a sunny day. But in the Christian tradition in Scripture, hope is not a mood. It is a virtue. It's a strength of character to be cultivated and practiced by individuals and by communities. Meanwhile, these three remain: faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. We've forgotten, I think, that we are meant to practice hope every day as the people of God, in the same way that we're meant to practice faith and love. And it's the attitude of hope which enables us to see what God is doing, both in society around us and in God's church. It's the perspective of hope which enables us to keep going when things are difficult and discouraging, and the perspective of hope which enables us to love the church enough to seek to see the church changed and to invest our lives there. And it's the perspective of hope which enables Simon in that moment to look out onto the lake, back into the night spent fishing, and back again to Jesus in the boat and say, because you say so, I will let down the nets. Thank you.